Lecture 10, The Church Under Attack.
Welcome to Lecture 10 of The Terror of History. In Lecture 9, we look at the context of heresy and the millennium, the different type of heretical movements, the different type of millenarian movements. In this lecture, in Lecture 10, I want to look at three heretical and one heretical and millenarian movement in the 13th century, in the late 12th and 13th century. And I want to contextualize these movements within the particular geographical, social, and economic setting of one European region. I speak here of an area which in the Middle Ages and by historians today is called Occitania, an area running roughly from northern Italy, the area of the Côte d'Azur, all the way into the Languedoc, and then south into the area of Catalonia and Barcelona. This is an area which in the 11th and 12th century had a cultural unit. They spoke a language which was called Occitan, of which Catalan is somewhat related to. It was the land of the Occitan. It was the langue d'oc. That is to say, they spoke something which was similar to French, was not French, in which the word yes was oc. And langue d'oc, the Languedoc, the place or the land where people spoke Languedocian. And if you travel through the south to this very day, this area of southern France, you could see everywhere, this is Qatar land, this is the land of the Qatars. I was there last summer, traveling across Occitania, as it were, and it is extraordinary, the historical presence of the heresy of the Qatars, one of the heresies I'm going to discuss today in this area to this very day. It's a tourist attraction, obviously. It is an area which was not in the 11th and 12th century French. That is to say, it's not part of the Kingdom of France. It is an area which is autonomous, semi-independent. It's an area of lordships, of great lords, of powerful lords who rule over the countryside from castles, which you could still see to this very day, perched in very high hills. It's a beautiful area. It's a wonderful area. It's an area which is perhaps among the most beautiful areas along the Mediterranean coast. This area in the 11th and 12th century was an area which was also lax in its religion. That is to say, the Catholicism, the Christianity of Occitania in the 11th, 12th, 13th century was one that was not necessarily very orthodox. The priests were more interested in living a good life than in pious or orthodox life. It is also the region where courtly love was found. It was the strongest region for the practices of courtly love. Courtly love, in fact, originates in Occitania. The first troubadour poetry in Occitan, in the language which you also call Provençal, is where the first poems are written. So it is a world which is very different altogether from northern France in language, in culture, in religious practices, and in political organization. And it provided, in many respects, a very fertile ground for the emergence of heresies and, to a large extent, also millenarian movements as well. The first one I want to consider here is what we call the Valdensian heresy, the heresy of the Valdensians. Valdensians are heretics from the 12th and 13th century, and there is still to this very day a Valdensian church in Italy, in northern Italy, which is now integrated into the Protestant denomination, but which is still very faithful to the practices that were developed in the 12th century and in the 13th century. So the Valdensians play a significant role in the religious culture of the West in this period and even later on as well. The founder of the Valdensians was a rich merchant, probably a moneylender, named Valdes or Waldes of Lyon. He has been awakened to his new beliefs by hearing the history of St. Alexis, who had given all his wealth and who had become a saint by the denial of his wealth and property. He went to consult a theologian, and the theologian and the priest, and the priest guided him to that passage in Matthew, which I quoted when I spoke about Francis. Early on, the passage in which Jesus said, a rich man will go first through the eyes of a needle, and a camel will go first through the eyes of a needle before a rich man enters the kingdom of heaven. And therefore, what we have here is, as it was the case with Francis, a reaction to the growing materialism of the age, to the making of money, a kind of turning point in which Valdez and people like him feel, in a sense, turn off from the growing secularism and materialism of this world. If you are truly a Christian, then how could you be a rich merchant? How could you accumulate wealth? Are you not placing your soul in mortal danger? And thus, in one of those acts, which in many respects parallels the life of Francis, though Francis is later than Valdez of Lyon, he gives up his wealth and he places his two daughters in a famous monastery, Pont-au-Bourg, where Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine are buried, and he takes on the road to preach this new message. His message is one of apostolic poverty, imitation of the way in which the apostles lived, traveling from place to place. They travel in groups of two Valencians, and they go and preach, and they think of themselves as Orthodox. They are preaching the news. They are, in a sense, doing the right things. They come under the suspicions of the church, because one of the things that Valdez does before he gives up his fortune is, in a sense, to have the scriptures translated into Provençal, to, in a sense, make the scriptures available to the people. And here we come to a very important point, a very important moment in the history of the West, because it is a question of control of language. If the Bible is in Latin, and Latin is a language which is only accessible to an elite, to an educated elite, therefore what we have here is a monopoly of knowledge. By translating the Bible, something that Luther will do later on in the 16th century, what you do is you take that control of language from the established church and, in a sense, disperse it among the people. So the Valdensians insisted on the idea that they can, in fact, break the control, the monopoly of language which the church had over the scriptures, and preach the scriptures to the people in their own language. Clearly, this is going to lead him into very serious troubles. By 1179, Pope Alexander III opposed the preaching of the Valdensians. Essentially, you should not go around, people who have not been given the sanction of the church should not go around preaching absolute poverty or apostolic poverty, or indeed translating the Bible into the vernacular. By 1182 or around 1182, Valdez was excommunicated and declared a heretic. I want to, in a sense, go back to the kinds of things that I said in the previous lecture, which is, of course, that the line between orthodoxy and heterodoxy is a very thin one. Francis is an orthodox, a mystic, a saint of the church, because when forbidden to preach early on by Innocent III, he is still acquiesces to the witches of the church. Valdez is a heretic because he refuses to accept the actions of the church which forbid him to continue with his mission. And therefore, we see how heresy, in a sense, is dictated by the moment, that we have to locate them within the specific context of the time and the actions of individuals. The Valdensians, once they are excommunicated, take on a radical position. Walking around the fields of southern France, two by two, they espouse ideas which now go counter to those of the church. The first one, they attack the authority of the priests and of the monks. In many respects, they are similar to the Donatists, an earlier heresy of the 4th and 5th century, which says that a priest or a monk who is not a true Christian cannot perform his office. This is one of the most serious heresies in Christendom. The idea that if a priest is sinful, the sacraments that he performs are not valid. The church, of course, will have none of that, because if you are going to disqualify all the priests who are sinful, then how many priests would be left? It's the same as disqualifying all the politicians who are crooked. How many politicians are we going to be left with? Clearly, there is a separation which the church will insist on to this very day between the individual and the actions of the individual and the performance of his or her duties within the church. So the first Waldensian attack on the church is that the priests have no authority. We should not accept the authority of priests. We should accept only the authority of exemplary Christians. The second one was the denial of purgatory. And we already talked a bit about the birth of purgatory in the 12th century. And the Waldensians correctly identify purgatory as an entirely bourgeois creation, as a way in which the rich could have their cake and eat it too, meaning that they could accumulate wealth and that they could still escape the fires of hell by doing a few pious deeds, by buying masses, by, in a sense, engaging in some practices which come into being only in the 12th century. Purgatory is really an invention of the 12th century. We know the great book by Jacques Le Goff, entitled La Naissance du Purgatoire, The Birth of Purgatory, which tells us how purgatory is constructed. And it is, of course, the creation of an intermediary place between heaven and hell, in which now people can escape and wait for liberation or entry into heaven. And you can buy that entry into heaven with money. You can negotiate for your salvation. Bourgeois will do this. They will negotiate for the salvation by buying masses, by paying people to go on crusades for them, by paying people to go on pilgrimage for them, by making donations to the poor, very ritualized and formulaic donations, but those that, in a sense, are ways of bargaining for salvation. You don't really have to be a good Christian now, because, well, if you have money, you can now purchase your way into heaven, which is in many respects a denial of the Christian ideal of apostolic poverty. So the second thing that the Waldensians does is to deny the idea of purgatory. And finally, they embrace a radical evangelical morality. That is to say that those who engage in this religion, and that is, by the way, the case of all small heresies, that is that the heretics who embrace this belief are taking extraordinary risk. They are placing their lives and wealth in great danger. So therefore, they are truly committed people. There is something in history which historians sometimes fail to take into account, which is the deep passions, the abiding passions and commitment that some people have for their beliefs. And, you know, I am a social historian, and I sometimes ignore the importance of these elements in the making of history. There are people who will do irrational things because they believe in them. And that is a force which is very difficult to pin down as a historian. It's the same as leadership or charisma. How you pin it down? How do you explain it? So by adopting a kind of radical evangelical morality, the Waldensians, of course, preach by example. These are people who live the life they preach, who live in poverty, who go out, who give the consolatum, the kind of only sacraments that the Waldensians have, the consolation of entering into this deep-seated belief in apostolic poverty, in the denial of the world, in the denial of the authority of the church to determine who you are. In some respects, these are forerunners of the great Protestant Reformation of the 16th century. It is a kind of priesthood of oneself. You live your life as a Christian, as a true Christian, and then there you are. The Waldensians, of course, will be persecuted in the 13th century, will be ferreted out by the Inquisition, as we shall see in the next lecture, but will survive as an active force and will become intertwined with all the heretical groups later on, with the radical Fraticelli, with the radical Franciscans, with some of the flagellants, to create a kind of latent but always present kind of underground anti-establishment, anti-Christian. Not anti-Christian because they think of themselves as a true Christian, but anti-church groups throughout Western society, which will create a kind of revolutionary ferment from which millenarian movements will draw a good number of their followers. From the Valdensians we shift to the Cathars. And the Cathars is a very different kettle of fish. Because the truth of the matter is that though I am calling the Cathars, or Catharism, or the Albigensian heresy, as they were called in the late 12th and early 13th century, a Christian heresy, the truth of the matter, of course, is that Catharism was a very different religion from Christianity. Was not really a Christian heresy, but a religion into itself. Catharism has very ancient roots. It goes back to the preaching of Manes, or Mani, again another one of those Persian Iranian thinkers in the early centuries of Christianity, who was a dualist. He was a dualist. He posited, in some ways following from Zoroaster, a world divided between two opposing forces. One, a forces of good and the spirit and light. Two, the forces of matter and evil and darkness. And these two forces are in continuous struggle, one with the other. I cannot even begin to tell you how extraordinarily important Manichaeism, that split between the body and the spirit, is in the Western tradition. It is something that we have inherited and that we almost unconsciously feel to this very day, the tremendous importance of the Manichaean dualism. Dualism plays an extraordinary role not only in religion, but also in our philosophical outlook. Perhaps the greatest of all church fathers, Augustine of Hippo, in the late 4th and early 5th century, spent a time before his conversion to Christianity, actually before his conversion to Neoplatonism and then to Christianity, as a Manichaean. And it was only meeting a Manichaean elder who was not very bright that convinced him that this was not the way to go. But Manichaeism provided a very good explanation for the existence of evil, one of the most troubling questions within religion and certainly within Christianity. That is to say, if there is a God who is good and fair and loves mankind, from where does evil come? Where is the origin of evil? Because, of course, you cannot attribute evil to God. Otherwise, what kind of a God is this that allows all this evil to exist? And therefore, Manichaean was very attractive. There is a Manichaean religious experience or practices, which we call also the Bogomil religion, in the east of Europe. And it makes its way slowly to northern Italy and then to southern France. And Catharism prosper tremendously in southern France for many reasons. By the way, Catharism is the name of the Cathars, and the Cathars are the pure ones, that is to say, the ones who withdraw from the world. They don't eat animal products, they restrain from sex, they live pure lives as a way of, in a sense, withdrawing from the world and coming close to that one of the dualist elements, the elements of the good, the elements of light, of the spirit, to be as spiritual as possible, to escape the body conceived as a prison. But they did not insist, which is what makes this religion so attractive, they did not insist that everybody lives like this. You could, in some respects, lead a normal life. And if you lead a normal life, but you believe in the Cathars and cooperate with the Cathars and attend their services, then you might also be a sage, you might escape from the oppressions of the world. So that the Cathars rejected all sexuality and procreation, no meat, no eggs, no milk, no cheese. In a sense, it's a way in which you escape the world, you become pure. Now, sort of pinning down Cathars' beliefs is very difficult, because what we know about the Cathars, we know essentially through mostly the texts of the enemies of the Cathars. And this is something that I was saying on the first lecture. That is to say that we are reading hostile accounts of Qatar beliefs. There are several Qatar's documents, and I can read from you because I have them with me here, although that might not be necessary. There are some Qatar texts which show some of the ideas of the Qatars, but essentially most of the information we have about the Qatars is from hostile sources, from inquisitorial trials, from attacks against the religion. We know that the Qatars have certain sets of beliefs. We know that the Qatars believe that the world, since the world is matter, that the world was made not by God, but by Satan. This is a way in which Christianity serves as an overlay over Manichaean beliefs which dated back almost to the beginnings of Christianity. So in a sense, you impose certain Christian terminology over ancient beliefs. The world is made by Satan. God, in his, her, or its, in a sense, love for mankind, sends Christ, who is not a human, but a vision, an illusion, to redeem humanity and to save humanity from being enthralled by the material world. So God, in fact, sends an image, which is the Son of God, to man down there to, in a sense, save mankind. Jesus does not die in the cross, which is why the Qatars hate representations of the cross, and they hate churches as well, because they are representations of the material world, whereas the true world is that of the spirit. So they believe also that, and this is unclear too, that one of the ways in which man is created by the devil, of course, and God, in pity for them, gives them a soul. And it is not clear about where these souls come from. Are these the souls of fallen angels? Or do they believe also in the transmigration of souls? So that there is a belief also in transmigration as well. So you could see how this, in fact, differs tremendously from Christianity as well. Satan as the evil God, free, and then the question is to free oneself from the flesh so that the perfected refuse to kill, to take oaths. In a sense, they stand apart. We also know that socially, a good number of the Qatars are people who know how to read and write, that they come from the kind of middling sorts, the lower nobility, the mercantile classes. We know also that the Qatars allow women to play a role in the religion which is forbidden to them within Christianity. So in a sense, what we have here is a religion which is quite open, which allows people to come in and to play a role in it, which is not possible in the highly hierarchical world of the Catholic Church. And they expand. And the truth of the matter, of course, is that the Catholic Church in the South doesn't really, in the Languedoc, in Occitania, doesn't really worry about this. Okay, you live, we live, we all have wine, this is Provence after all, the weather is wonderful, the wine is terrific, the Mediterranean is right there, why worry? But, some people are going to come through Occitania on their way elsewhere, and they are going to worry. And this is what happens. A man named Dominic of Guzman, a native of Castile, we know him in history as Saint Dominic, comes through, as do all the priests and monks traveling through the south, and are shocked by the way in which the area is essentially in the grip of heresy. And they come to the Pope and ask permission to go and preach to these heretics and try to bring them back into the fold. It is then that the mendicant order, a second mendicant order, that of the Dominicans, is created. Dominicans not because they are the followers of Saint Dominic. Dominicans because they are the hounds of the Lord. Dominus Canis. The hounds of the Lord. And they come there to convince. Because, as we shall see in the lecture which follows this one, this is a period in which the church tries to bring heretics back before they are excluded altogether and sever from the relation by preaching, not necessarily by violence. And so the Dominicans come into the South to preach Christianity to the heretics and are not very successful. And in fact, there are some encounters between Dominicans and heretics leading to the killing of one of the Dominicans, or one of the papal legates who is in the area representing, as it were, the position of the Pope. And thus, something unique in the history of the West takes place here, which is that the Pope, Innocent III, preaches a crusade against the Cathars. This is a golden opportunity for the people in the north of France to embrace a religious cause and to come south and attempt to extend their power into the south, to integrate this area of Occitania, which was not part of France, that is to say, politically not integrated into the Kingdom of France, and to bring it into the Kingdom of France by using religion. It was not lost on the people of the South that this crusade, preaching the name of religion and as a way to combat heresy, was in fact a political move as well. And Catholics and Cathars fought side by side against the invaders. And the king of Aragon and Catalonia, the king of the crown of Aragon, Peter, who was known as Peter the Catholic, came to defend the south against the invaders from the north. And he died at Muret in 1213, fighting on the side of the Cathars. The story is told that at Béziers, one of the towns in the area, after it is conquered by the northerners, they are told, "How do you distinguish between the Cathars and the Christians? How could you tell them apart?" And the leader of the occupying force says, "Put all of them to the sword. God will know his own when they get up there. Kill them up. God will know who is right and who is wrong." And therefore, the Cathar heresy is squashed by these invaders from the north and essentially by the papal crusade. It is the first time in which a crusade is preached not against quote-unquote infidels in the east, but a crusade is preached against people who are Christians but heretical. In the next lecture, I will describe in luxury of details how you deal with the Cathars who still remain alive after a fashion, after the invasion. And that will be by way of the Inquisition. Let me point out to you very briefly how Catharism survived. If one reads Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie's great book, Montaillou, which is the promised land of error, you could see that how in this small village in the Pyrenees, or close to the Pyrenees, Montaillou, Cathar belief survived, so that almost half of the population of this village are really people who still practice Catharism, who travel back and forth across the Pyrenees, who go back and forth and who maintain this network of heretical views, how heresy survives 100 years, 150 years after the defeat of the Cathars in Languedoc. The third and final movement that I want to look at is very briefly, is that of the Fraticellis and the Flagellants. Francis, as I pointed out to you, was a great watershed in the history of Christianity. Everyone, not everyone, but most people, specifically the people at the bottom, were certain that Francis essentially was the second coming of Jesus. He had received the stigmata. He has 12 disciples. So that essentially the order splits between two groups. One, the radical Franciscans, whom we call Fraticellis, and two, the observant or regular Franciscans who have the new reform order about which I spoke in the past. The Fraticelli see Francis as a sign that the end of time is at hand. Together with the ideas of Joachim of Fiori, everybody thought that 1260 will mark the end of time, the beginning of the millennium. And because it was the beginning of the millennium and all the signs were there that the millennium was at hand, you have the development of the flagellant movement. People who will go around beating in groups of 33, beating their backs into a pulp by their suffering, in a sense, bringing about the end of time, the end of history, which has been foreshadowed by the life of Francis. The flagellants, the church doesn't know what to do with the flagellants, because after all, they are on the one hand orthodox, and then at the end they are condemned also as heterodox, and they are forbidden, because they represent a great threat. And the orthodox view of the millennium is, of course, that you cannot usher it in, and that you cannot predict when it will happen, that you cannot say, I know when it will happen, that it is only in the mind of God who knows when the millennium will take place. Thank you.